Hello and welcome to On the Line. I'm Carl Richter. Sharday, James and I had a really interesting conversation with Hollis Thornton, who teaches at UAHT here in Texarkana and is involved in a really fun project coming up in connection with an online charity comics convention. If you just thought, oh no, another episode about comics, I think actually this episode might be for you, because Hollis shared some fascinating insights about what makes comics a unique art form and why they're so popular. So I hope you'll give it a listen. Here we go. Joining me in the studio is Hollis Thompson. Hi, Hollis.
Hey.
And Sharday James.
Hi.
So we're here because Hollis is working on a really interesting project related to a fundraiser that's coming up later this month. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about what you're doing with them?
Yeah, I am on staff at an event called the Multiverse Fundraiser. This is an annual virtual Comic-Con fundraiser jamboree, is basically how they put it. It is an event that was started during COVID when two people, Kelly Edwards and Crayley McDonald, who are two professional cosplayers that together they do a thing called Phoenix Sisters Cosplay. They were really depressed that there were no more Comic-Cons going on because COVID had put them all out of business.
We had a couple canceled here in town.
Yeah, exactly. So they decided that they were going to do a virtual Comic-Con, and they didn't want to just do it as a normal Comic-Con, but thought they might as well help people while they're at it. So they made it a charitable event. And the first year went really, really well. That was before my time, so I wasn't there to see it. But they did really well, and so they kept it going as an annual thing. And every year they pick a different charity to benefit. And this year it is a charity called Comics for Kids, which is an organization that provides kid-friendly comics and toys to children in hospitals and cancer centers.
It's what a great cause.
It is. Yeah. It's a really, really good cause.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about you, you're also a English professor.
That's right.
So when it comes to you directing this live audio Batman drama, how did you go by of getting picked, or is something you signed up for? How does that work?
Yeah, we should explain what we're talking about. You wrote and are directing for this Comic-Con, an audio drama Batman story, right?
That is correct. That was my idea, and it was actually an experiment for their part. I pitched it to them when I became on staff of this fundraiser, and I just pitched it to them as an idea, because what I noticed with the first year I started helping was that it is very audio-based, right? I mean, you obviously have the webcams, but everyone they were interviewing and everything they did was very podcasty. As a matter of fact, some podcasts they had that were just recording live episodes as a part of the Comic-Con.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I got that and the comic book theme, and I have been reading comics since I was, like, 5 years old. It is a lifelong art form that I've been engaging with. And so I just pitched to them, hey, what if we did a audio drama that was like the live radio shows they used to do back in the 30s and 40s, where they weren't pre-recorded. They had people in the radio studio live, and all those sound effects had to be a Foley artist live there with them. And I said, we could do something like that with everyone being on their camera separately. So not in one studio, but we could still do it that way. And so they said, cool, let's try it out and see what happens. So I wrote the script, and I pulled from some of the professional voice actors that were actually already associated with that event. There were two of them, Chris Jowls and Laura, she goes by L.W. Salis, if I get that pronunciation right. They are two professional voice actors.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so they were already associated with the event, so they just said, sure, we'll be a part of it. And then I roped in other actors I knew in town and other places.
Wow.
Yeah, and so we've gone on.
So I read that the story is based on one of the first Batman stories in 1939, was it?
Yep, That's correct. Actually, the first Batman story.
Okay.
Yeah. The Case of the Chemical Syndicate, which was the very, very first Batman story ever. Bob Kane, the artist, and Bill Finger, the scripter, the two people who created Batman. That was their first attempt. It is actually kind of funny because most of the plot is actually ripped off from another story, which was a pulp fiction story about the Shadow, which was kind of one of the proto superheroes from the pulp magazines. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So why Batman? Why not another superhero?
That comes down to two things. First of all, frankly, just the popularity of Batman makes it an obvious mm-hmm. choice as a character for an event like this to get people to tune in. Because the goal of this fundraiser is ultimately to be as entertaining as a show as possible, to make people as interested to watch the show and to hear about the charity and consider giving a donation to it. So that's the one thing. The other thing is, frankly, personal preference, because as people who know me well can tell you, from the time I was 4 years old, I was wearing a homemade Batman costume that my grandma made for me.
Oh, so that's so cute.
I have been a Batman fan for a very, very, very long time. And I'm particularly familiar with the character, so I knew how to write the character. And I'm also familiar with that original run of comics by mm-hmm. Bob Kane and Bill Finger from the Golden Age. So yeah. That worked really well. And we decided to do it as a period piece, so it's also set in 1939.
I wondered about that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we are definitely taking a lot of inspiration from that original run, but also from other things. It isn't necessarily a one-to-one adaptation. I put my own spin on it, and we have a lot of other elements that we're pulling from. Like, for instance, I'm also a big fan of the Pulp Fiction author Raymond Chandler.
Oh, yeah.
If you've ever read mm-hmm. him, yeah. So what we've done with Jim Gordon, for instance, who is played by David Zwirn, who is a great, very talented actor in town, actually, in Texarkana. Mm-hmm. He's done things with Tex Rep before, those sorts of things. Yeah. We make him into a very much a kind of Philip Marlowe type character. He's cool. A very, yeah, very world-weary police commissioner who's been through a lot and has been around the block.
Comics are such a visual medium, obviously. What sort of things do you have to do to translate to that to audio? I mean, you mentioned the Foley, the sound effects.
Yes, and that was one of the biggest things. We, once again, really lucked out with our Foley artist. She was actually the last one to come in because that was actually the hardest job to find, mm-hmm. actually, out of all of them. We have one named Willow Schuyler, who came in last minute. She was associated with the Comic-Con again, so she came in and is doing a great job. But besides the sound effects, the biggest challenge as the script writer was actually just that, somehow finding a way to get there to be pictures in their minds, mm-hmm. right, that's only told through audio. The solution I wound up doing was actually different from the comic, having narrators. And so we have three different narrators throughout the piece, three different characters who are telling you their perspective of the story. And they are telling it to you in a way that they are being more descriptive of what happened with their narration. That gets you more of the pictures in your mind.
Wow. So how long does this process take for you to write all of this?
That is a good question. I actually do a lot with drama already. I'm a mm-hmm. playwright. I've had plays performed before at A&M and also in Paris, Texas, at their community college. So I have a little bit of experience there. For this particular project, as soon as Kelly and Crayley gave me the okay to start working on it, that was back in the summer, and I took off on that script as fast as I could, actually, because I had already had it in my mind for a while. And it took me, I want to say, about 3 weeks to write the first draft, and then after that, I go through a process where I always have somebody else look at my work before I give it to anyone mm-hmm. else. And that first person is always my wife, Haley Patillo, who's also a music professor at the same college I work at. And she always catches things that I miss. Because even as a professor, When it's your own stuff, mm-hmm. it's different. You mm-hmm. miss things that you would see in somebody else's work, but you go through there. So we had that round. And then our first rehearsal with actors was in November. And that's when we had the cast together, and I had them go through it. And as I told them, script is subject to change until the day of. So after they did their thing, I did a few other edits to it based on their performance, and that's how we got to it. Although, to be frank, even as late as our very last rehearsal, which happened on Tuesday mm-hmm. of this week, one of the actors was sitting next to me while we were doing it. And as he was looking at the script, he found some typos.
Yeah, we always say around here, everybody needs an editor.
Yeah,
exactly. Everybody, even if you've got an MA in English.
Mm-hmm. So even though you have all this experience in writing, you know, different plays and things like that, is there someone that you admire from, you know, to take from to your work?
Oh, that's a great question. For this play in particular, I really do appreciate Bill Finger, who was the original scripter in those Batman comics. Mm-hmm. I really do enjoy his way of plotting stories and how he went about doing things. It's really interesting. If you look at the history of Batman comics, even though Bob Kane and Bill Finger only did the original run for maybe 10 years, maybe 15, give or take, everybody else who's come afterwards and done Batman stories, and no matter what medium it is, for the most part, they are building off of and adding complexity to what those guys came up with originally. So I'm very inspired by his way of storytelling, his dialogue. That was the seed that I just expanded on in that story. I also, personally, I always have to give credit to Dr. Brian Billings, who was a professor I had at A&M Texarkana.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for him, I would not be the person I am today. Like, he was one of the professors. He was not the only one, because there were a lot of great professors I had who took an interest in me as a student and really helped me develop. And I took playwriting with him and was a drama minor. And he's continued to be a friend even to this day. And he is definitely very much, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be the playwright I am today.
Yeah. And I love that you said that, because I think so many people, oftentimes so many things that we do in life, we always end up giving credit back to like a teacher or a professor. And I hope they, you know, realize like how much they, you know, really impact students.
Yes.
So I love that.
Yeah. The other big one from A&M was Dr. Drew Morton.
I had him.
Yes.
I interviewed him a few weeks back about his book.
Cool. Yeah. So I got to take a comics class with him, actually. And that is a big part of how I came to know as much as I do academically about comic books.
Yeah. We've been kind of comic book heavy here.
Yeah. And that's another question that I have, too, because you're looking at someone who's not into comic books. I don't have any brothers or anything like that. So what interests, you know, you all so much about comics? And when I look at them, I'm just like, okay, they're pictured with words. Just watch the movie. So what's so interesting about comic books?
I want you to know how proud I am to welcome Hostetler Roofing as a sponsorship partner. I had the pleasure to meet with some of Hostetler's staff, and I could tell they really mean it when they say they're all about honesty, integrity, and accountability. They get it that contractors don't have the best reputation, and they want to change people's minds about that by setting an example. Everything Hostetler Roofing does is about taking care of customers. Whether it's a commercial or residential job, maintenance, repair, or a whole new roof. That's why they offer 5- and 10-year workmanship warranties on everything they do. Hostetler has a huge variety of roofing styles and materials available, and they're happy to help you with options to pay for their work, from affordable financing to applying for government grants. It all starts with a free inspection. Just call and ask, and before you know it, you'll get the best advice out there about your roof. Visit HostetlerRoofing.com or call 870-557-4797 to get started. And please mention you heard about them here.
That's a great question. I actually just lectured about this before I came here. Ooh. So that's cool. So if you want to understand comics as a medium, the book that you have to read is titled Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. He is the foremost scholar of comics living today, for sure. And he wrote this book actually as a comic. So it's a comic about comics. Mm. And in that book, he describes this concept that he calls closure. And he said that it's a function of the human mind where, for everyone, since no human is all-knowing, the only thing that we ever actually know at any given moment is what's right in front of us, right? Like, the example I use with my students is, do you know for sure that your car is still intact right now? And the answer is no, because I actually had one semester a student whose car blew up in the parking lot. Yeah, so you don't know that for sure. And so McCloud explains that all of us only see what's in front of us. We only see fragments of reality at a time. But our mind constructs a view of reality based on those pieces. So just like when you're only ever in one room at a time, but if you know the building, in your mind, there's a layout of the rest of the building. Even though you don't know for sure if, like, a car is rammed into a room, you know, and ruined it. So there's there. So McCloud says that comics are really the only art form, narratively, that exploits that capacity of the human mind. Because for a comic book, you have these different panels that you have to use your imagination to connect the dots, almost like one of those connect the dot drawings. Yeah. And so it's like a dance between the creator of the comic and the reader filling in the images that the author gave you and turning that through your imagination into an experience
that
of a story.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
And another appeal, of course, is just the superhero.
Yes.
I read that, that's an emphasis of your scholarship.
Yes.
And you're working on relating that to biblical narrative?
Yes, I am. So I'm an odd duck in terms of the the English and drama field. So most people just have one field, but I'm decently eclectic in that one of my main scholarly interests is biblical literature, biblical studies, Bible as literature, and then medieval literature, which is what I wrote a lot of my thesis on, and then the pop culture stuff. So actually, this kind of circles it back around to the beginning of all this stuff, because how I met Kelly and Crayley, who are the chairwomen of this convention, is in relation to an academic-y book I was working on, and still am working on, but academic books take a long time, about biblical studies and superhero culture, because I see a lot of links between those things. I'm somebody who studies the Bible academically. I'm also a Christian. And I see a lot of things in superhero culture that both are really, really interesting to me, connections to biblical studies concepts, and also things that are at times disturbing to me, as a matter of fact. So I interviewed them because one of the sections is actually specifically about female superheroes. And I was trying to think to myself, how can I really best understand these characters? And I realized the people I need to talk to are female cosplayers, because they are people who know these characters better than anyone else because they actually embody them. Right. And so that's how I met those two and got that going. And an example of like how it connects to biblical studies would be, there is tons and tons and tons and tons of academic discourse going on about women in the Bible and also female superheroes. And these conversations are actually related, I think, in a number of different ways. There is increasingly becoming an awareness of the fact that the Bible as a text itself is a lot less misogynistic than a lot of the people throughout history have used the Bible for misogynistic ends. Like, for instance, you see all of these female characters in scripture who really subvert gender expectations in a number of ways. You have characters like Esther, for instance, who is, if you just read the text, a victim of human trafficking, actually, literally, if you understand that story, what's going on there. And yet she uses that position of originally being a victim and turns into the savior of her people. And you also, in Proverbs, really fascinating stuff, you have a personification of the concept of wisdom as a woman, right? Lady Wisdom in the early chapters of Proverbs and all throughout. And then you tail into the end of Proverbs in Proverbs 31, where the whole book ends with the description of, some translations translate it as virtuous wife. There are other scholars who actually argue that that term should be heroic woman at the end, who seems to be indicating that human women, like the ones we see throughout Scripture, have the opportunity to become embodiments or incarnations of this cosmic female wisdom figure. And I think that that's actually dovetails really well when you start to look at these female superheroes like Wonder Woman and Black Canary and Captain Marvel and Batgirl and Supergirl, and it goes on and on and on. So, yeah.
Are there direct analogies? I mean, people have often said the Superman story is analogous to the Moses story, right?
Very much. And Jesus, for that matter, because there is a time in the comic books where Superman actually dies and then comes back from the dead. So, you know, yeah, it's pretty on the nose. Yeah, another thing to realize is that most of the people who created these superheroes back in the Golden Age, and the Golden Age, by the way, defining terms, I apologize, is roughly speaking 1930s to the end of World War II. That's what's called the Golden Age of comic books. That's where most of what we recognize today as a superhero comes from: Superman, Batman, Captain America, those sorts of characters. And those three characters, along with many others, were created by Jewish guys at that time, usually teenagers or young men. And I think that the cultural influence there is undeniable, especially with someone like Superman, right? Yeah, the Moses analogy. Also, Samson, you know, is there as well, with the superhuman strength and all those sorts of things.
Wow. That's very interesting.
Oh, yeah. So also with comics, where do you see comics in the future? Because at one point in time, people, you know, waited on a street corner to go inside of the store to go get the newest comic book. So where do you think comics will go in the future?
Ooh, that's part of what this book is actually about, where looking at where comic book and superhero culture has been and where it's going. I'm actually quite concerned about where it's going. I have part of the reason that this book came into existence was one day I walked into a comic book store, and I've been in comic book stores since I was like 9 years old, right? I am very familiar with comic book stores. I've always felt at home in comic book stores. And I was really disturbed. I was actually more uncomfortable than I've ever felt at a comic book store, because I looked around at all of the new titles and the new comics that were coming out. And what I saw was not just what's happened in the history of comics before, like in the 80s or the 2000s, where people started to realize you could tell complex, meaningful adult stories with these characters like Superman and Batman, etc. That I think is really cool, and I really enjoy a lot of those stories. But what I saw there was not that. It was like they were taking the concept of serious adult superhero stories, and they were like going to the lowest common denominator they possibly could of like shock value and just reveling in darkness, to be frank. And I always have found that superheroes are ultimately about hope. And so that profoundly bothered me. And I was like, I've got to say and to think about this and to say something about this. So,
yeah, there's a whole conversation to be had about the Punisher in today's right wing culture.
Yes, that is very fascinating. When I lecture about the Punisher, I talk about that, how in the South, like, that emblem you will find on trucks all over the place. And that is something I think we need to think about, whether that's actually a good thing or not. Yeah.
Yeah, and so kind of going back to the Multiverse fundraiser, you know, the charity that they pick, like you said, are comic books for children. So what do you think about, you know, these new generation of kids being introduced to comics maybe in a way that you wasn't? They're going to have a different perspective maybe.
Definitely. That's one of the things I'm actually most concerned about. I really think that parents need to understand that comics are not necessarily for kids in general. And there are most comic books that are being produced right now by the mainstream publishers, Marvel, DC, most of them being produced are not aimed at kids. They are definitely aimed at older teenage and adult audiences. And there are some stuff that if you just threw a kid a Batman comic today, you might have some things that exposed to that kid that you really don't want exposed to them that could be really damaging to them. So I think that there needs to be a better balance. And I do see the industry starting to move this way to having a recognition that you can have comics that are aimed more towards an adult audience, and you can also have comics that are aimed towards a child audience, and that those two markets are both legitimate. You don't have to do one or the other, and you don't have to alienate a specific audience. You can do middle of the road.
Interesting. Dare I ask if you had to get permission to do this Batman story, or does it fall more into the realm of fan fiction or something?
So the way that the big companies right now, Warner Brothers and Marvel, well, Warner Brothers, who owns DC Comics, and Disney, that owns Marvel Comics, the approach that they have generally had with fan-made, non-for-profit projects has been to leave them alone and not bother them in any way. Especially when they, like the one we're working on, is specifically for a nonprofit organization that's benefiting hospitalized children.
Right.
You know, that would be a technically, they do have the right to shut down any production like they want, but they have given kind of hat tip permission to these fan-based projects, especially projects like this, because the amount of PR disaster that would probably be on their hands if they did something like that.
Yeah, if they shut you down, I'll get it in the paper.
There you go. Exactly. Exactly. So usually, generally speaking, you can go on YouTube right now and you can look up some very expensively produced fan films. Like, for instance, actually, an actor that I'm going to be interviewing as a part of this Comic Con. His name is Kevin Caliber. He's actually been in some official superhero movies, like the MCU movies. He's been a stunt coordinator and things like that. He has a Superman movie called Superman World War, which is set during World War II. It's actually quite interesting. It's Superman versus Hitler. That is a fan film that has over 1 million views on YouTube, right? And Warner Brothers has no interest in shutting that down, right? They are, in some ways, you could actually argue that it helps their brand because it continues to keep that in an awareness. And by continuing to encourage people to do that, as long as they're not making money off of it.
Explicitly pretending to be DC.
Yes, because that would obviously hurt their brand if they were trying to deceive people into saying this was an official DC project. Right. Which, again, for legal purposes, this audio drama is in no way a official project of DC Comics, Warner Brothers, or any of its companies.
Well, I can't wait to listen to it. When is this going to be, and how can people get access to it?
It is going to be, I'm going to remind myself, because as an English person, numbers are not my thing. The Batman audio drama will premiere Saturday, January 27th at 4 p.m. Okay. So that's when we will do it. And once again, this will be a live audio drama. So part of the fun of that means our actors are doing this live. So if anything goes wrong, they've got to make it work, is how that goes, just like they did back in those old radio shows. And it will be at that time. You can watch it both on Facebook and on YouTube. It'll be live streaming both of those places. For Facebook, you just go to the Multiverse Fundraiser webpage, and once we get going, it will be streaming all of the events throughout the convention. And then on YouTube, you can look up Phoenix Sisters Cosplay. That is the official YouTube channel of the two women who run it.
Great. I'll put links in the show notes and help people find that. I think we're about out of time. So thanks very much for coming by and talking to us a little bit. This is really interesting. I can't wait to listen to it.
Thank you. I really appreciate your interest and giving us this medium to spread the word.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Take care.
On the Line is a Texarkana Gazette podcast recorded in Star Bear Studio, right here in downtown Texarkana, USA. Follow On the Line on our website, texarkanagazette.com/podcast. To support the show, post a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. And please, spread the word by sharing a link or telling a friend. I write, produce, and edit the show, and I'd love to hear from you. Email me at krichter@texarkanagazette.com and let me know what you think. I write, produce, and edit the show, and I'd love to hear from you. Email me at krichter@texarkanagazette.com and let me know what you think. I'll see you next time on the line.